Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Fields, the podcast. I'm Wyeth Marshall.
And I'm Melissa Metrick.
On Fields, we're bringing you the stories of people who are working in the world of urban agriculture. For money, for fun, for art, for justice, to feed the hungry, to green the city, or to uncover its history.
In each episode of Fields, we'll delve into one kind of food that's grown in cities, one technology used to grow, or one project that teaches us something about our relationship to farming in urban environments.
Moreover, we'll investigate all the whys behind getting up in the morning and working as a farmer in the city today.
You don't need to be a farmer to enjoy this podcast, or even a foodie.
We're going to tell fascinating stories and break down the realities and possible futures of urban farming to their elements.
Hey everyone, this is just a quick update. Our interview with Annie Novak was recorded in March, so some of the classes that we were talking about may have already happened, but she has plenty of classes that are coming up. So again, she teaches at Atlas Obscura. She also has classes at the New York Botanical Garden. She manages the farm, Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, where there may be volunteer days. And you could also check out more of her work with Growing Chefs. So thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Fields Podcast. We have a very special guest today. We're really excited. We have Annie Novak here. Hi, Annie.
Hey, Melissa.
And we're sorry to say, but Wyeth couldn't make it today because he has jury duty. But, you know, it's a very important task or a very important job that we all have to do. So, but we're still going to talk to Annie. Annie, thank you so much for being here. And we'll just kind of get started. So, Annie, can you introduce yourself and all of the wonderful things that you do? We'll just kind of keep it short and then we'll go in depth.
Yeah. So I currently am the manager of a facility called the Edible Academy, which is at the New York Botanical Garden, the garden in the Bronx. I also run and helped co-found the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, which is a green roof vegetable farm in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, that is the first commercial green roof farm, at least in New York City, definitely the country and possibly the world. And I also run a nonprofit called Growing Chefs that does food education, principally with school and after school programs, but also sort of out in the community, primarily with children, but increasingly with adults, as everybody realizes how fun it is to connect to food. So those are my three main gigs, with free time and hobbies abounding.
Yeah, I feel like whenever I talk to you, I always feel like you're working on some amazing things, and then of course, your long-term kind of projects. I was wondering, can you speak a little bit? Yeah. So how did you get into growing food in urban areas in general? We could go all the way back because Annie, you and I go very far back. But yeah, if you could just share with everyone how you started in urban agriculture.
It's funny. The transition between agriculture, my interest in agriculture generally, and my interest in urban agriculture was very seamless. I think now there are a lot more people that I'm meeting who are coming into agriculture from an urban landscape, which was not the case for me. Like, I didn't know, community gardens for sure are very strong in New York City. And I think if I had thought it through at the time, I probably would have just joined a community garden and stopped there. But I was just interested in the agricultural landscape generally. I had done a research paper in college on chocolate farming in West Africa, working with West African farmers. And that, I think, was probably my first formal foray into an agricultural landscape. I was really interested in thinking about more formally something called commodity chain analysis, but informally just like, where is food coming from and where does it go? And that narrative has always interested me. And I think starting with chocolate, because it's such a great plant and delicious food, was a good gateway for me. But once I got back into New York City and had graduated college and started working at the green markets and working with farmers upstate, I think my intention really was to always go back out into rural or peri-urban areas. But I was lucky enough, starting with the botanical garden, which has the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx, which has such an awesome edible food growing facility. I was lucky to get involved in projects that were city-based that allowed me to stay in the place that I love most dearly in the world and also work with this new material that I was really excited about. But I'd point out that path seems unique to me still, because I find that folks really do separate themselves into, I'm specifically working in urban farms or I'm specifically working in rural farms. And I had the real pleasure of covering the whole spectrum early in my career, which was really lucky.
Yeah. And I feel like especially working with rural farmers, just getting, you know, in being around rural farmers, I always felt that the farmers market was a good segue, where it's like, wow, I could get to know these rural farmers. I have access to these rural farmers and I could ask them what's going on their farms.
Totally.
How are they actually doing this crazy job that they do? You know, driving to the farmers market, multiple times a week for like 2 to 3 hours, growing all this stuff. It's just kind of amazing. And also just being able to pick their brains, you know?
You and I connected over that very early on. And I think one of the things I really loved about it is it gives you a sort of regional perspective, because, you know, urban farming is really important. And I love that it gives people like a visual and participatory access to agriculture, but the real impact on like air quality, watershed, food production and mass, like that all happens outside of New York City, no matter how big we build our rooftop farms. And so, you know, when you and I first met, Melissa, and we both geeked out on farmers markets, and then I got the chance to pull you up to the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx, and then we started working together on a private rooftop farm. You know, these are all really small space projects with big social impact. But like the questions we would have, like, where do we get the best transplants? What are the major pest problems in the area? What fungal diseases are killing all the basil right now? Like that stuff where you and I would turn to the farmers we worked with, because they were the ones who had that bigger landscape perspective to share. So I totally agree with you. It's an awesome resource. And unfortunately, when farmers are at the farmer's market, they're often their most tired, dealing with too many people. So I feel like where we really lucked out is we actually have like good relationships with people. So
yeah.
We're not pains in their ass, but I agree with you. It's unfortunately, like, I feel like PR has become part of a farmer's job while at the market. It's like a little exhausting, but
in between bathroom breaks or
or just like trying to stay awake, you know?
Yeah.
It's a long ass day.
So how did you find yourself up in the botanical gardens, and how long have you been there? And if you could explain your work there a little bit more.
Yeah. So the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx is this incredible 250-acre museum, basically. It is literally a museum. And it has this extraordinary campus with like a 50-acre native forest. The site that I work on is a 3-acre vegetable garden with a classroom facility and a greenhouse and all sorts of other bells and whistles. I was in college in Westchester and had applied to an ethnobotany internship about a month before I graduated college. It was a very last minute thing, due to, you know, circumstances in my life. I got picked to work in the children's education department instead. So I had gone into it thinking I would work, you know, ethnobotany is this space within academia where you can look at like the relationships between plants and people. And I think sort of based on my relevant experience and resume and how I presented myself, they were like, you know, let's put her in education because she seems like she likes to talk a lot and she's a good learner. And it's true. So I, maybe some other qualities as well, but I ended up working at the Edible Academy, then called the Family Garden, in 2005. So it's been a really, really long time.
Wow.
Yeah. And where I feel really fortunate is that I started as an intern. I became an educator. I was promoted to coordinator and now I'm a manager. And so I've had this path where I've really learned everything about the site. I've had a chance to help develop the site. I have colleagues I've worked with for that entire time, colleagues that I've hired in. It's a really, really incredible space. So again, it's called the Edible Academy and it is open to the public. So if people want to come visit, we have so many programs you can get involved in, including volunteering alongside of us and learning how to plant, which is in some ways like the most hooked up community garden you could possibly ask for, because we have such a fantastic facility up there.
Yeah, the facility, it was so amazing when, you know, when it became the Edible Academy. Yeah, the Edible Academy before it was Ruth Howe Family Garden. And just like now, you know, there's greenhouses and there's just like all of this amazing, beautiful. And the work was always beautiful and amazing and just so professionally like set up. It's just so amazing to have this resource within New York that maybe like, you know, a lot of people be like, oh, I'll go to the New York Botanical Gardens, but they won't know about this whole educational facility where you could take, you know, your really young children there to start from the beginning, you know, of like...
Yeah. Because that's what you got to do, right? You're a Sprouts educator, yeah. So you worked with the little guys. What were some of your favorite parts about that?
What was it? I just feel like you all set it up so easily. Like, okay, this is usually how we do a lesson. Like, you're going to teach this certain subject. We're going to do this amazing snack with like fresh vegetables and things like that and get the parents in. And I think I remember making like this really delicious... it was like a cabbage salad or something. I think it had like maple syrup in it and raisins, and it was kind of sweet but salty, and it was like really delicious. Or we just had so much fun, and then they got to do these little projects like sow seeds, and it just seemed like such an enjoyable experience to have like your little ones, and the parents could come along or you know their guardians or whoever. And be with them for that experience. And I think like that's something that a lot of people may be lacking in urban areas of like, wait, how do I actually do this? How do I get my kids involved, or, you know, youth in general involved? So it's kind of amazing that New York Botanical Gardens has that. And also that just like they have such a rock star like you help, you know, like managing this facility. And it's so crazy. I was just thinking about, so it's like you've almost been there for 20 years. That's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, it isn't. One thing I'll point out about the Sprouts program that you were part of is, so that the Children's Gardening Program has been a component of our education department since 1956. I mean, we have photos going back to when the program, at first it was free, and then they realized that didn't help with retention, so they started charging a dollar. It's always been a really affordable program. And the site that you worked on before we evolved into the Edible Academy, the Ruth Ray Howe Family Garden, that family, the Howe family, has actually been a really important part of developing the children's education work at the Botanical Garden. We have two other children's education sites. So it's, I don't, you know, we're not here to talk about children's education, but as you just pointed out, getting kids involved at an early age and giving them that, you know, literally just like the bandwidth and the space to indulge in biophilia and to be in fresh air. We have kids that come in and their parents' whole goal is like, get them to eat a vegetable. And I'm like, okay, but also let's get them breathing fresh air, touching soil, you know, engaging in curiosity and a free play. Like there's such a wide spectrum of benefits to it. And to just bring that up a level, the Botanical Garden, and then the work that I do with Eagle Street and with Growing Chefs, we engage with adults too. And it's through the exact same teaching pedagogy. I teach adult education classes using literally the same pedagogy that I do with kids. I just happen to make the vocabulary more challenging or the questions more reflective. But I think that's really important, because something that I fell in love with about agriculture really early on is a cyclical process of learning, this opportunity every season to fail and try and try and fail, and how that encourages, if you're, you know, a curious optimist, as I try to be, it encourages you to learn for the rest of your life. And that's, you know, even on the grumpiest days, like some of the things that I love the most about the farmers that we've worked with are that they are innately curious people. I think ultimately probably like freedom loving is the big part, but engaged in curious people, because it's hard work and it requires a constant learning process. So, you know, when you say, oh, Annie, you've been there for almost 20 years, and I'm like, girl, I could be there for 200 years. Like there's just... Particularly an institution like that, where I'm in a small section of a very large, you know, we have over 500 employees. Like there's a huge, huge institution at this space. And, you know, I met earlier today with someone from our forestry team, and like, we were talking about the health of the urban forest. It's literally the forest next to my campus.
Yeah.
I look at these trees every day. And this was one of my first conversations with someone about, you know, the specific topic we were talking about. And I was like, man, I could spend the next 20 years just hanging out in the forest. Like there's so much to learn. So, you know, it's part of why I've always been so grateful. We have the opportunity to bring in people like yourself. Like we have this rotation of educators who work with us we learned so much from you coming in and bringing your ideas and creativity. And then it keeps the work fresh for me too. Like if I'm going to stick for 20 years, I want new staff to work with and new ideas percolating.
Yeah, definitely. And just the folks that it would draw in general as educators.
Oh my God. Yeah. Best colleagues ever.
Yeah.
Like total sweethearts, super cool science dorks. You're absolutely right. Like really the best colleagues you could possibly ask for.
Yeah. And also just a mix of people who have been there for a decent amount of time. And then also, you know, the fresh blood that kind of comes in and everything else. But also like you mentioned, surrounded by, just scholars and folks that are so passionate about the work that they do and all different types of work, you know? So like you were talking about forestry and how that could also just tie into, you know, the lesson plans that you do or, and also your other work. Oh God, there's so much work that you do in general. Speaking of which, two things, can you just mention really quickly the, how you work with adults at the New York Botanical Gardens via the classes that you teach there? And then also leading into Growing Chefs.
Yeah, totally. Okay. So I started teaching adult education classes a while ago. I think at this point I've officially taught over 10,000 adult students, which is bananas.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. And that's through online learning with the New York Botanical Garden, and then prior to the pandemic, in-person learning. And then I also teach with Atlas Obscura, which has been so phenomenal for the last 2 years, 3 years now. And then I do, you know, like lecturing and that kind of thing. So it's great. I find adult learners to be extremely self-motivated. You know, they're all of the courses I teach are outside of a certification program. So they're there because they want to be there. I have a range of topics I like to cover, everything from sort of like the basics of organic vegetable gardening all the way up to the last class I just finished teaching on tree communication, which was hot topic. People were all fired up to learn about that. And I'll just say a quick note about that. The Botanical Garden has a phenomenal adult education program. I mean, you don't have to take a class from me. You should just sign up. With Atlas Obscura, phenomenal, very wonky, all over the map, super curious, curiosity-driven class topics. My aim with tree communication was to think about sort of the popular culture concepts that are out right now. Like, you know, I think at this point, everybody's aware that mycorrhizal networks helps trees communicate. And what I was interested in was thinking about how the human perspective of communication, talking, feeling, all these concepts and perspectives that really are linked to our species. How does that translate or fail to translate to trees, which are an entirely different species, an entirely different kingdom, and living on a completely different time scale? So what I find wonderful about the opportunity to teach adults is that you can tackle big topics like that, which bridge science and philosophy, ethics and botany. Sometimes they can give you really sassy, mean feedback, which is super helpful because I learned from that too, about, you know, sort of how they might agree or disagree with the perspective I'm offering. But it also gives me a chance to explore topics I'm curious about. So a lot of times, you know, you mentioned that the Botanic Garden, our children's ed program, have a very rigorous curricula that we follow. We create a scaffolding that we think best suits sort of the learning standards for children. When I teach adult ed classes, I take that into account, but a lot of it really is about exploration. Because one thing I've really taken away from agriculture, botany, being part of a scientific institution, like, you know, the museum that is the Botanical Garden, is answers are awesome, but really learning how to question things is even stronger. And coming at things with your prior knowledge and exploring, you know, really making sure you're not making assumptions, really making sure you're making direct observations. And then from that, asking, what more do I need to know in order to draw a conclusion?
So it's a very scientific background. Like or coming to it in a scientific,
approaching it with the scientific method in mind. Yeah,
exactly. The scientific method. Because I think that's so interesting what you were saying about how, I guess, would it be anthropomorphizing, trees in a way, or mycelium and how mycelium, you know, work with trees or even working. I don't even know if that's like have a symbiotic relationship with trees sometimes, and sometimes they decompose trees or sometimes they're parasitic to trees, you know? So it's like all these different relationships, but, yeah, there has been almost this wildfire of like, oh my God. And I, you know, I'm guilty of it too. Like I was just teaching my students about mycorrhizal networks today because I was teaching them about mushrooms. But that is interesting, this aspect of how much do we anthropomorphize, if I could say that would be the term.
Because this class was much longer than our conversation will be, I can give you my main takeaways as briefly as possible. One thing is, I think the language that we're limited to when we use English does put us in a bit of a pickle in terms of how do we express a relationship that we're perceiving between two kingdoms, fungi and plants, in a way that doesn't have implications in our understanding of that word. So I'll just use the example of calling something a mother tree and talking about how a mother tree might like help support. So here's two words already, mother and support. Unhealthy trees or related trees in the area, right? Like trees of the same species, or there are now, it's been shown, relationships between different species of trees in the same area. So what I would dissect about that is, can I use that language, or if you and I were to discuss this, use that language and not have certain preconceived notions in mind? Does mother imply that tree is older and also the tree that planted those other trees? Or does mother just imply a caregiving aspect? And then also, what does that say about the way we think about mothers? Does it mean that, you know, when we say support, that there's this idea that instead of a two-way passage of nutrients, for example, there's only a one-way passage? And why, what's like, is there an inherent motive that trees have to do that? Okay, so there's so much complication. That's just the language. So the science of it, I find fascinating. And when I ended up teaching this class, what I really did is I just said, look, here's the plant kingdom, and here's how plants work. Here's how trees work. And here's how trees are so different than other plants. And what implication does that have? As a perennial plant that produces woody tissue and that has minerals and waters moving through it in a specific way because of the woody tissue. Okay. And then fungi. How many millions of kinds of fungi are there? How do they function differently? Like you just said, there's some that are saprophytic and some that aren't, like some that eat dead tissue and some that don't. Okay, so then you read this research, right? And a lot of the controversy, if I'm going to be as brief as possible, seems to land on one, sensitivity around language, right? Like we shouldn't go out there and be like, trees and mushrooms are like bonding and creating relationships, whatever, like semantics. But the other thing I'm wondering is why in this kind of relationship, why do we need to assign motive when another way to think about it is if the inherent desire of most living things on earth is to reproduce, could we consider them a single acting organism? So not that mushrooms and trees are the same, right? They're separate kingdoms, separate entities. But when they start to link up like that, is there a way to think about this where rather than a relationship of give and take, it's actually just one organism functioning together? And I say that in the same way I would think about my gut bacteria as part of me. I don't walk around saying, hi, I'm Annie. And then like, also, oh, by the way, here's one big gut bacteria. Like I just talk about myself.
Yeah.
This is again, like the briefest version. And then the last thing I'll say is that one thing I find really interesting in thinking about non-English language speakers, Robin Wall Kimmerer being like the most well-known exemplar of this, but she, in the Potawatomi language, there are words that, inherently have action embedded in them. So like we have nouns, those nouns don't necessarily have gender and they don't necessarily have action. So the classic example that I use in my classes is she has this word that like we have the word for bay, which just means water in a space. The word for bay in Potawatomi means to be a bay. It is an active choice that the water is making to be captured within land and that it has this inherent animus to it, like spirit of life. So I say that because I think where we are limited when we talk about relationships between trees and fungi is I have to use a word like mother, because there's no word that means specific to plants, the type of nutrient sharing that may have a sense of tenderness, but that tenderness might be specific to plants. There isn't that language because we don't prioritize plants for one, the fuck all, like that's a problem. And that's why we're losing them at a great extinction rate. But we also just, I don't think in the English language have that sense of tenderness towards non-human things and sense of empathy and openness. So I'm not even talking about how we like legally don't protect plants. There's all this other stuff, but that would be the short version of this class and the way I think about these things.
That's amazing. So really bringing linguistics in and how we think and speak about plants in general, or identify plants, and I guess also how we identify with plants.
Yeah. And identify with isn't a problem. That's where anthropomorphization becomes helpful.
Yeah.
Like if I think mother tree makes me love trees better.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Like, let me conserve trees because I treat them like a mother. Like, great. But it where it makes me nervous is when you get this pseudoscience. So that's, again, that's kind of why I come back to this, like, well, I work for the New York Botanical Garden. Like, I truly do teach mostly from a perspective of, like, please understand the fundamentals of botany. And then let's talk about what is communication? Because I don't want you to think that trees are out there being like, yo, I have nitrogen. You know, there's actually like osmosis happening. And like, you know, like there are functional chemical things happening that allow for that process to occur. And that's
where I started. And that was interesting when you were talking about like, could the plant and the mycorrhizal be one organism? And for some reason, what I was thinking about was coral. And how a lot of times, you know, we think of coral as one organism, but it's actually multiple organisms in one. But it's totally, like, kind of creating this ecosystem, and one lives within the other, and they kind of both benefit from each other. And just also this idea of, I don't know, where I was going with this a little bit in my mind was, can an ecosystem be an organism?
Exactly. You know? Right. And particularly when you're thinking about trees and mycorrhizal networks, it's, you know, it's this, I guess to me, it's less astonishing that we're finding out that they do communicate. And it's more astonishing to me that we just assumed they didn't. Because when you have something like fungi that's been on Earth for, I want to say 500 million years, and I'm not sure that's long enough. Basically, it's twice as long as tree plants have been. And in that, we're just talking about like hundreds of millions of years. I think it's trees that, I'm not going to remember, but the point being, this is something that like so predates our concept of life on Earth in so many ways. It's so outside of the scale we think at. How could there not be a relationship? And so saying that it, you know, then you're pointing to something really valuable, which is if you don't think about it in terms of ecosystem, it makes it a lot easier to destroy. Because when you start to individualize a plant within a landscape or a type of plant within a landscape, you take away all the units that go into making that plant survive. And that, you know, it's a problem with modern landscaping. And, you know, you and I, Melissa, had the pleasure of working at a rooftop garden that is very diverse. I mean, there were over 120 species of plants on this tiny little roof garden, this private little roof garden, green roof. And I think one of the great strengths of that garden is that it's introduced and native plants, but that diversity like really, really helped. Whereas, you know, you could go to a green roof and see only sedum. Or you could go to a roof garden like so many of the ones you worked on with plant specialists that are like boxwood. It's horrible. No plant on Earth lives that way.
Yeah, I've always been curious about this idea. And I think usually as growers, especially if you're using, you know, natural practices or organic practices, one of the things that, you know, at least I try to work towards is creating an ecosystem and having a lot of biodiversity, because of course that's going to help with pest management. That's going to help with the health of your plants in general. But I've always thought about this, you know, studying from this like scientific background, scientific method. If a farm, let's say, was a forest, like in nature, this sounds so weird, but what would be the ideal kind of ecosystem? Because I still feel like sometimes people just like, we'll put plants together. And of course there's companion planting and there's all these other things. But I've always thought of this idea of like, how can I, and I don't know if I'd want to say necessarily like mimic nature. And maybe the closest thing that's coming to that right now is this, is like agroforestry. Where people are kind of creating these ecosystems and seeing how these certain species of plants and, you know, fungi and bacteria and everything else kind of work together. And of course, animals as well. But look at it in this historical ecological background and maybe like where these plants evolved or how can we actually create these? I don't know. I've just been curious about that lately.
I think you're pointing to it when you say, where do these plants evolve? You know, one space that's really interesting to explore are native edibles and how can we create food landscapes that, you know, not only are growing plants that are, you know, endemic to the area, but also growing them in a way that makes sense for that local ecosystem. One of the things that really strikes me about farming and why I've been like going deeper into non-farming plant love world is water use. You know, a lot of we could talk, and I think most people would on your listening to this kind of a podcast would already know about like some of the dangers of pesticides and herbicides. And, you know, the reasons we have to use these on vegetables, one, it's because there's an expectation that vegetables are perfect. And then two, it's because vegetables are often introduced from Europe, from Asia, like, you know, some of our favorite vegetables like kale, like that's not a Native American plant. So you have to use pesticides and herbicides, or quote unquote have to, because, you know, they're not within our ecosystem. So, but the water thing really kills me. I mean, above and beyond anything else, like, whoa, what a absolute waste. And, you know, I've learned through the botanical garden, primarily, and then through Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, the green roof farm I manage, that there are ways to plant plants so that between mulching, intercropping, there are techniques, building up the organic matter content in your soil, there are techniques that help retain water. And that helps stop the plants from getting stressed. And then you mentioned mycorrhizal inoculants, bacterial inoculants, like all these things that help extend the capacity of the plant to draw in water. Because that's really the one of the primary roles of fungi, is extending root systems so that they can draw in more water. And then also they help with like bringing in potassium and other minerals that are harder for plants to absorb. But that, if you're building healthy soil and you're growing plants that do well in that microclimate, it's just, yeah, it's just more responsible. And I don't think you necessarily have to put like a umbrella culture on it. Like I'm doing agroforestry, or I'm doing biodynamics, or I'm doing, you know, forest farming or permaculture. I like that stuff. I think it's a great place to start because it gives you sort of a structure to follow. But to me, really, it's like, if I'm committed to a space, and it's why I've worked at the place I've worked for so long, I get to know that space. I know when the soil dries out. I know under what conditions the plants start to crap out. And I can start to lean into choices that support it. And Eagle Street's probably the best example of that, because that is a 6-inch deep, super dry green roof media. It's not great for vegetables. And it never was. And I knew that from the jump. And so what we ended up doing over time is, after growing like 40 different varieties of vegetables to see what stuck, narrowing it down to plants that worked well for that site. So instead of trying to bend the site to my desires or my customers' desires, I went the opposite direction. I said, look, Mediterranean plants that grow in dry, rocky soils do real well for us. So even though they're not native, they, when I don't cut them in the time flowers, that supports pollinating insects. And then I can sell the flowers for $1 billion because people in New York are crazy. And then it does really well because it doesn't need a lot of water. And the best is it's a perennial. I'm just picking on time. There's other plants we grow, but it's a perennial so that over time, no pun intended, the root systems are establishing themselves, and that's helping the plant thrive in a site that's very dry and prone to drainage. So I just, at this point, I kind of like give up on, like, I would love to grow a melon. It's just never going to happen. I'll grow a melon somewhere else. And I think that's probably the way I would approach most farm sites at this point, is like, see what the land is telling you and lean into it.
Yeah, that is such a great point, and especially being on a rooftop farm, and also being on a rooftop farm in a city, and specifically New York City, right? And you guys are up in Greenpoint in Brooklyn, and just how urban areas, I find in general, they can be tough areas to grow in. And also being on a rooftop, it's almost like you are on a mountaintop, you know, like that's the environment, where it's super exposed, you're full sun. I think you're still full sun, right?
Yeah.
So super exposed, full wind, because you're right off the water, which is going to change the climate as well. And New York City in general is right off the water. And also not a lot of soil. So that means you don't have a lot of that buffer/support that soil holds. Just like how soil holds water, temperature, all these other things. But it is amazing that, you know, you're looking at your space and you're thinking about, okay, what has evolved in these conditions? And also what it's great knowledge to have, because also as we are going into a climate that is more exposed, that is a lot drier, You know, it's like maybe that is the future of farming in general. Like, okay, the work that you're doing right now on rooftops, is that going to prime certain places of like what they will become in this sense of like more exposure to wind, all these other things in general. But how you could do that in like observing the space and doing it in a very intelligent way. And also that you guys don't have irrigation, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have a hose. I have a hose that we have access to. We aim to not use it. And the theory with that is that it's twofold. One is, I think the role of a green roof in a city like New York that does have stormwater management issues, really it's ideal that we are ready at any moment to accept stormwater from a large rain event. So if I'm irrigating constantly and the soil is constantly saturated, it's less capable of absorbing those heavy storms. So, you know, it sounds a little pious. I'm not trying to be like, you know, the green roof, you know, whatever. It's important to me ethically. And then the second piece is that I actually have found it's actually a wonderful exercise to learn what plants do well in dry soil. So if we were to irrigate more consistently, I could grow that melon I want. But to me, it's actually more fascinating to figure out what does well in dry soils. But we do have a hose. So if I'm like sowing seeds, I have to have some supplementary irrigation.
Yeah. I'm also curious because I've started to notice in seed catalogs that certain seed companies are starting to push more varieties that are drought tolerant. Have you looked at these at all? Or do you kind of, are you curious about this sense? Like, I guess it's like, you know, what variety is it and what does that actually mean to be drought tolerant and where and all these other things. So of course there's a bunch of specifications to think about, but have you been interested in that at all? Or just the idea of like, I'm going to, you know, I know peppers work in drier areas. They can deal with the winds. They do great in this sunny exposed location. Like that's where they want to be, or rosemary or thyme, or like, you know, just these Mediterranean plants in general. But yeah, I was just curious about that. Have you noticed that seed companies are starting to push these more drought tolerant or not really?
So for the rooftop farm in particular, we save seeds. We're so microclimate focused that I actually just save the seeds off of our plants from last year. And then that's what we usually sow. So I haven't noticed it for that. Something I've been noticing in seed catalogs where we're looking at catalogs up at the botanical garden is a growing interest in native seed cultures, like corn that's been grown in the U.S. for like 200 years, 300 years. So that it could also just be that's something that we're like actively looking for because it's part of a garden project we're working on. But I like the idea that you could look for drought tolerant. I know that like slow bolt has always been a big thing with leafy greens. And then, yeah, the huge growth of local seed companies, like seed companies that are saving local seeds and selling them locally, and the indigenous and native seed, has been awesome to see. And that's something I feel like has been changing over the last decade.
Yeah, that's such a great topic. And also that you all seed save. I didn't realize, you seed saved.
I mean, I'm a cheapskate, so that's part of it.
Well, but the thing is, it's like before seed companies, that's what people did. And that's also like, you know, maybe it'll take hundreds or thousands of years, but in you all selecting, you're of course selecting the best plants to save the seeds from. So that is going to help you out in the long run of like, you know, you're picking the crops that are doing the best in your environment. And then
it helps within a year, like literally one season to the next. Yeah. Cause if you think about it, you know, To get a, you know, seed true to type might take me a couple years of growing, like 8 years of stabilizing it or something. But no, I've noticed literally like 1 year to the next, like if we're selecting for an improved variety, like that next year we'll have good results.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And so true to type, meaning that, that's with any seed or just with hybrids? You don't save seeds from hybrid.
No, we've done it from anything. And I think that's what I mean is like usually, cause you know, if we're saving seed from a hybrid and I plant like, it's going to be like 90 of the plant the next year. Cause you get so many seeds off of one plant. We'll just select for what looks good. But no, I just mean stabilizing it. Stabilizing it would take, at this point there are some seeds that we have saved almost since the beginning of the farm began. So would I consider them stabilized? No, I mean, I guess it would have to be, you know, like an easy example is our calendula. I've been growing calendula from saved seed now for 9 years because I'm not going to buy new calendula. Like calendula produces a million seeds and like, it doesn't really matter what color it turns out as. So we do every now and again, like get weird colors or weird shapes, but it's the same calendula genetics for what I need. I need a calendula that can handle being in dry soil.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Do you have, for those folks who are listening, do you have any advice for saving seeds, like where you store it, that type of thing? Or has it been like a work in progress in you know, storing good seed, or it's just been kind of easy?
Well, it's easier than you think. I'm going to say that universally for all things gardening. I think folks, and I love it because they sign up for my classes and I want you to sign up for my classes, but it is, I am completely self-taught. I mean, I learned from working with people smarter than I am, but did I ever take a class? I think I've taken soil science, but I just like being mentored and reading books, is my primary go-to, but with seed saving, the only thing is, you know, you have to understand a seed contains a living plant, right? It just hasn't been enzymatically activated. So you want to keep it in a place that will not make it grow. So ideally it's a cooler, drier space, water and sometimes light, depending on the seed, helps them germinate. I think a lot of people are super curious how long you can keep seeds for. I just wrote an article a couple years ago for Martha Stewart Living about a woman who sprouted a date seed that was pre-biblical. And I like went to Israel and met the fucking tree, and it's wild. You know, when it's a male tree, but if they ever hybridize or if they ever cross it with a female tree and pollinate the female tree, you'll be eating a date that is the same genetics and ostensibly the same flavor, taste, and shape as a plant that was eaten thousands of years ago.
Wow. That is amazing that you actually went there, because I remember reading an article about that.
I met the woman who did it.
Wow.
Easy. I love her. She's got like such deep farmer energy. She's very soft-spoken. She's kind of grumpy. It was the best. But yeah, the tree is cool. Methuselah is the name of it. And it's a date tree. But all that to say, if you save seeds in good conditions, you know, please don't save it for 2,000 years. But like, you can save a tomato seed for 5, 6, 7 years. That's fine. And I find great pleasure in that, because, you know, I often give seeds as gifts, and it's sort of a future promise, right? Like if I'm giving it to you and you live in an apartment, it might be 5, 4 years before you have a place to plant it, and that's okay. Just keep it in a cool, dry place.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I remember in one of our first episodes on fields, we did an episode about seeds, and I remember wife mentioning how seeds are almost like time travelers. Like, you know, like this seed was from 1,000 years ago, which is so incredible. And how different our environment or the earth was then compared to what it is now, or how different our environment now will be, you know, from even 100 years or 50 years or 20 years because of climate change. So it's just so interesting. And I know I'm anthropomorphizing plants right now, but this idea of like how smart plants are, where it's like, I'm going to, put my genes in this, I'm going to have them be dormant and only wake up when it is the right time for them.
It's a beautiful lesson for us all, really. Yeah. To be a seed in all things is a very cool way to think about your life and your plans and your schemes and your dreams.
That's great. Yeah. That's
There's a great Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau I can't remember if it's the name of an essay or a line in the essay, it's to have faith in a seed. And he talks about that exact concept, how there's so much potential locked into this tiny little organism and what that can teach us about the way we should live and be. I'll say where I think you're right in anthropomorphizing is that with food crops, it is completely permissible to talk about the sensibility and the cultural relationship within those, because food crops are plants we have chosen and selected and hybridized. They are our story. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't walk around telling you how to think about an acorn, but food crops, yeah. And the other person I met, this woman, Elaine Slozy, who helped with the Methuselah date. The other woman I met while I was in the Middle East was a Palestinian woman who runs the Palestine Seed Library. And she talked about how she has been walking around Palestine, gathering seeds from people who are afraid that the plants that they grow, the crops that they grow, will not have a welcome home anymore. I mean, these are like their great grandparents' melon seeds. Because with everything that's going on between Palestine and Israel right now, there's not as much available land space. And then the crops that they're able to grow is limited. So I found that really compelling. And it definitely, again, it's called the Palestine Seed Library. So if folks are interested in learning more about that story, you can look it up. I also wrote an article about it for Martha Stewart Living as well. But it is to me one of the better examples of thinking about how seeds, we do have a direct connection, like a cultural storytelling connection through the way that we think about seed saving.
Yeah, I've also, that made me think of the amazing work that Steph Geller does, and she's part of the Long Island Seed Consortium. But I remember when I was getting my master's, I took this class called Sustainability on the east end of Long Island, and we visited her farm, and she does a lot of seed work. She breeds so many different varieties. She grows them out, she breeds them. And she mentioned this idea of when regions are about to go into war, how it's really important that sometimes folks would get in touch with her and be like, listen, my area might go into war, so can I send you some of these varieties so that they will be safe? Because I don't know what's going to happen. And like when you lose these varieties, not only are you losing the biodiversity, but you're also losing this culture. And it also made me think about, you know, of course, the stuff that's going on in Ukraine and Russia right now. And we were actually working on this project at the NYU Seed Library of thinking about wheat varieties that are specific from, you know, northeastern region. And are some of those varieties in danger or jeopardy in general? So it's kind of interesting. It's like not only climate change is a huge one when it comes to biodiversity and how many things are going to be able to survive and adapt, but it's also like our key to adaptation is biodiversity, but also just this sense of this cultural connection and how human caused things like war can also destroy that biodiversity and cultural
I went off on a tangent there. No, it's not a tangent. And I think you're interrelating those ideas really well, because if I'm feeling upset that, you know, potentially Palestinian food genetics are going to disappear because of, you know, land conflict, et cetera, it is a much larger, broader, bigger war that we're fighting with climate change. And that's going to impact not just our food crops, although that's one of the things we focus on very heavily because we like to eat food, but it is impacting just the broader plant, animal, fungal, bacterial, viral world. Like it's a much bigger war. And I, you know, as a person who generally trends towards optimism as best possible, I don't often frame it in that term, but I started working in bird conservation more actively about 6 or 7 years ago. And it's really, really hard to talk about that without it feeling like genuine conflict. Birds are so charismatic and have so much personality as individuals and as species. And so I find myself relating to them a lot differently than I do with plants. And when I see, you know, dead birds because they've struck building glass, for example, that feels like war. Doesn't feel like a sad, distant climate change, you know, Anthropocene concept. That feels like actual battle. So I'm glad you related the two. That makes a lot of sense to me.
And I'm going to go out and reach and relate two more because we have to go really soon. But A, just if you could speak about a little bit just about the origins of Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, and for folks who have never heard of it, what that is. And also, for some reason, I was just thinking about like, I wonder in Annie being on a rooftop farm and being in the sky all the time, if maybe that's piqued your interest in birds, but also how you got into ornithology. And I know that's like two very broad, wide things, but just in general, just for folks who may not know about the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm and Growing Chefs, just the origin of that really quickly. And then also your work with ornithology, because I know you're really passionate about that right now and you're doing incredible work with it.
Thanks. Yeah. So the Botanic Garden, I got there in 2005 as an intern. I wanted, as a young 20-something, to have something really powerful on my resume. So I created a nonprofit called Growing Chefs, and I named myself the director. That's a pro tip for everyone graduating college. Do it. You can start employing people you like. You can start developing programs you like. You can put director on your resume, and you can have a tax write-off for certain things if you're being very legal and judicious about it, which I am. So I loved it. That's how Growing Chefs started. And I did it, as I mentioned up at the top, as you know, I found schools and after-school programs to partner with. And we did STEM or STEAM-based programming using cooking and gardening as a way to talk about science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. STEAM. And it continues to be a passion to this day. So that operates separately from the Botanic Garden, separately from the rooftop farm. The rooftop farm, I was working at the farmer's market and was approached by Ben Flanner, who's the founder of the Brooklyn Grange. He was marinating on this idea of starting a green roof vegetable farm. And he and I partnered up very early on because I had vegetable gardening experience, and he had this idea. And so for the first year of Eagle Street, we worked together on founding that project and running it. And then the following year, I got offered the full-time job at the Botanical Garden. So now I work all days of the week. And then he went on to start Grange, Brooklyn Grange Farm, which is now the largest, and I believe continues to be the largest network of green roof farms in New York City, at least, if not the larger region or country. So it's really cool. I think I was lucky in both spaces to have been sort of plucked up in my early 20s into these careers that I really love. And did that connect to birding? No. What got me interested in birding? I was at the rooftop garden that you and I took care of, this beautiful rooftop garden in the Battery. It overlooks the Battery Park in Lower Manhattan. And I happened to be up there on the night of, I think, September 10th, it must have been, which is a moment in which the Tribune and Light, which is this beautiful installation of very high-powered spotlights, shine from where the Twin Towers were pre-2001. And the Tribute was shining these spotlights a mile into the sky. There are 44 spotlights in each array. So it's 88 high-powered spotlights next to this rooftop garden that you and I took care of. So I was looking at them and I saw a bunch of things circling in them. Like it looked like almost like ash from a fire. And I turned to the gentleman whose rooftop this is. And I said, wow, what are all those bats doing? I didn't realize there were so many bats in New York City, because that's, you know, what flies at night. And he sort of off the cuff was like, no, that's just birds. There's always birds in the lights. And I was like, what are you talking about? So I was intrigued, as I am when anybody says something enigmatic and slightly confusing. And I reached out to New York City Audubon. I found out that New York City Audubon had been running a program to figure out, you know, why these birds were stuck in the lights, how to stop them from doing that. It's to make a very long story short, not good for them. And that was the beginning of my fascination with birds because of two things. One, I didn't know birds flew at night. So a lot of migratory songbirds and shorebirds migrate at night for various reasons, which is just fascinating to think about. And the other is, I don't know, I don't think until that moment, I don't think I very fully realized how biodiverse New York City is. We see upwards of 60% of all species of North American birds in New York City.
Wow.
Yeah, we're very lucky. It's an incredible place to become a birder. So I'll leave it at that because I kind of want everybody to be teased enough to get interested, but I know we're running out of time. But basically, if you're interested in birds, you couldn't have asked for a better place to live. And New York City Audubon is a great organization to ease you into it. And then now the work that I do, I'm writing an illustrated book about this because so much of this work scientifically is studied through radar, and radar is really beautiful to draw, among other things. And then I'm on the board of the American Bird Conservancy, which abcbirds.org is hands down nationally, if not internationally, because it does work across the Americas, the finest, bravest, feistiest, strongest, best, most wonderful organization you could ask for in terms of bird conservation. ABCBirds.org, the fucking coolest. So I'm on their board. I stand them super hard. And I'll leave it at that. But please, everybody, pick up some binoculars.
And Annie, of course, very important. We haven't mentioned the book that you've already written. So can you just 2 seconds, brief? Oh God, it's just like so much work. It's just so incredible, all the work that you put out there and that you're doing. But yes, can you talk about the book that you've already written?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Renaissance woman, musician, gardener, teacher, phenom, back at you. But so I wrote a book called The Rooftop Growing Guide, How to Transform Your Roof into a Garden or Farm. It's published by 10 Speed Press. And it's great. I illustrated it with my friends Lauren and Liz, Elizabeth Timpone and Lauren Haynes. It's photographed by Naima Green and Jackie Snow, two incredibly talented photographers, and came out in 2016. It's really a good compendium. And even if you don't have a rooftop, the Rooftop Growing Guide includes a lot of basic information, a lot of things we talked about today, companion planting, intercropping, permaculture, seed saving. It's all in the book. There's even a little bit about birds.
Yes, so incredible. And I'm so sorry that we're going to have to wrap up soon. And I always love talking to you, Annie. It's always an amazing conversation. And thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and just your incredible perspective. It's just so amazing always to talk to you. But I did want to ask you one more question of how can people look up your work? Do you have, what are some classes that you're about to teach? So if you want to shout out some of the classes with Atlas Obscura, with the New York Botanical Gardens, if you have things coming up with Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, like you're looking for apprentices or all the things. So if you just want to talk about that for 2 minutes and how people can get in touch with you and look up your work.
Totally. Well, the nice thing is everything I work on is public facing. So if what we've talked about today excites you, you are welcome to these spaces. AnnieNovak.com is a good one. It's N-O-V-A-K. And my Instagram, which I think is AnnieNovak_, I can't remember, but it's Annie Novak. I have the little link in that bio will take you to a list of all the classes. The next class is coming up. The spring is the hot season for New York Botanical Garden program. So I have a whole bunch of things coming up talking about herbs, small space vegetable gardening, container gardening, rooftop gardening. That's all happening. My next Atlas Obscura class, which starts on Thursday next week, is called How to Read an Urban Landscape. And it's an exploration of botany and ecology, so that if you're sitting at a bus stop and just staring at weeds growing next to the pavement, you can immediately engage in that landscape in a really enriched way. I also teach a companion class called How to Read a Landscape, which is about landscapes more broadly, but you know, urbanites need their special niche. And then if you want to get involved in Eagle Street Rooftop Farm or the Edible Academy at the New York Botanical Garden, both of those spaces do take volunteers. So you can also look them up. A simple Google search will take you to all the right places. And then, Melissa, you mentioned the apprenticeship program. This is a program now entering its 1 millionth year. Well, technically it's 23rd. It's not possible. I don't know. We started it in 2010. It's been going for a while, but that is a program where you commit 3 months of volunteering, but only 2 days of the week for 3 hours per day. So it's 6 hours a week. It's very manageable with full-time jobs, which is essentially what I'm doing as well. And it's a training program. So you can learn everything that we just talked about in great detail and participate at the Eagle Street Farm. And yes, I would love people to apply. It's been a real pleasure. I'd say that the group of people I've met through that program, which now exceeds 175 people, have been the most brilliant, loving, beautiful, hardworking, inspiring, creative, wonderful, intelligent young people I've ever gotten a chance to know. And I hope my world is just always filled with people like that, people like you. It's just, it's a blessing, honestly, the space we work in. We really hang with the coolest people.
Well, thank you so much, Annie. Thank you for being on the show. And it's been such a pleasure to kind of pick your brain. I love picking your brain all the time. And also just kind of catching up and seeing all of the work that you're doing. And of course, like all of your such intelligent perspectives. and thank you again. So it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Annie.
Talk to you. Thanks, Melissa. Okay.
All right. We are wrapping it up for Field today. So thanks, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
Fields is powered by Riverside. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradio.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.